This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. And you can find out more at the website, allbook-books.com. Several things to mention in conjunction with this week. Sadly, the passing of singer-songwriter Robbie Robertson of the band, and then on to his own career. He was Mohawk and Cayuga descent, native. A lot of his songs representing the native peoples. He played with Bob Dylan as a guitarist. Not too shabby. But I was listening to one of his songs, Unbound. And, you know, as a writer, I'm always got my eyes and ears open for one-liners or words or phrases that jump out. So the one that jumped out is, "Nothing is forgotten, only left behind." Nothing is forgotten, only left behind. I think that's a good koan to ponder. I'm continually fascinated by memory. For example, driving to a town that one hasn't been in for years, but the memories come back. So, like, where are those memories? Are they in the town? Are they in the person? Or is something that happens when those two meet that it stirs it up? There are, you know, trees have memory, kids, little babies have memory, elders have memories. It's a whole huge topic. Gore Vidal wrote a book, Palimpsest. That's a word you can look up. It has to do with, like, when I think it's writing fades, and then maybe another layer is put on. I think it was he who said that we don't remember the actual events. We remember our responses to the events. So that's another koan to ponder. We don't remember the actual events, but we remember our responses to the events. So I guess one could say, like, if one got hurt, one might not remember the actual getting hurt, but the pain that one felt after one got hurt or something like that. So the Nothing is Forgotten, Only Left Behind is one segue. And the other segue is reading an article about Bruce Cockburn, one of my faves, Canadian, now in the U.S., singer-songwriter. Something like 38 albums. Just put out a new one, Oh Sun, Oh Moon. And back in the 80s, he was writing what he didn't want to call protest songs, so he refers to them as documentary poetics. Documentary poetics. That's a good phrase. I like that one a lot. But mostly I want to segue, well, both of those segue to a follow-up to last week's 1990 book, Noam Chomsky, What Uncle Sam Really Wants. Nothing is forgotten, only left behind, because I think it's important, the history. Now, most of this book, I've been familiar with the gists of it for years of studying. If I had read this in 1990, I would have saved myself a lot of studying. And a lot of searching, but that's the way it goes sometimes. And looking back, I still learn some bits, but I don't necessarily want to go on all the harsh and gory, saddening, perverse details, because that is some of the history of the U.S. is overthrowing democracies in other countries and starting wars and cutting off resources and on and on. It really, if you're not familiar with that, it's a study. And this book does it quite simply and concisely. It's only 100 pages and it's really small size book. But what I want to emphasize is that what I got out of it this time. Well, first of all, I want to emphasize one of the gists, aside from the financial interests, is the control of the people. So there are phrases like the threat of a good example, the crime of independence. There was some guy who considered the poor who seek to plunder the rich, democratic threat feared by dominant elites. So that's the pervading pattern, is that any peoples, whether it's in the U.S. or elsewhere, any peoples that have start to have power and gather intelligence and show their muscle in a peaceful way, that becomes a threat. And that's what gets squelched. And that's repeated over and over and over in the history. So I'm not going to go over it now. But that's something to consider, because I fast-forwarded that to this, the idea of control of the people. So what are they controlling? Well, this, you know, again, it goes way, way back to a lot of religious programming is to control people, that they need a middleman, whether, you know, nothing against priests or rabbis or imams or whatever they're called. You know, it's good to have someone to talk to, or a counselor or a guide, but there is a direct connection that we each have with the spirit. That's part of my path with the mystical Kabbalah. Kabbalah means a personally received teaching. So the example I like to give is the tomato plant on my patio is personally receiving sunlight, air, water, nurturing, love, etc. And those are helping it to live its true nature, to produce the tomatoes and whatever else it does. So each of us has that. What your fruit is, that's what I consider, you know, one of the purposes of life is to find what your fruit is. And it's not necessarily just producing a thing. It's, you know, your way of being, your way of talking, speaking, actions, etc., etc. It could be a craft, it could be art, it could be writing, whatever. It could be family, kids, whatever. That goes on and on. But the idea is that we each have a direct connection to both the spirit and the earth. That's why I started this year. I do walks in the front yard. I just walk with my feet, bare feet, to connect with the earth energies. And I walk and think and try to receive information and get some idea of what to do that day. And sometimes it answers my questions. I have a question in my head and I just walk around and I'm like, what do I do? Or I ask the earth to tell me, you know, give me a clue. And sometimes I do. I get an answer. Now, I don't know. I can't vouch for where that's coming from. But it happens. So that is what I want to highlight. That is what these geopolitical power, and it's not just the U.S., it's governments, it's corporations, it's religions, it's the educational system, and it's all around the globe that those, what they fear the most is free thinking and people controlling, in control of their own choices, and people receiving guidance from, you know, nature and the plants, instead of having to go to school and be indoctrinated. That's what they fear the most, I think. So the whole thing about control, and here's one thing that Chomsky says, it's about the system in general. Its function is not obscure. The effect is to make it impossible to find words to talk about matters of human significance in a coherent way. We can then be sure that little will be understood about how our society works and what is happening in the world. So the idea is to keep you confused. Another one, when a state is committed to such policies, it must somehow find a way to divert the population, to keep them from seeing what's happening around them. There are not many ways to do this. The standard ones are to inspire fear of terrible enemies about to overwhelm us, and awe for our grand leaders who rescue us from disaster in the nick of time. Now, this is 1990. This was written around 1990, but that got me thinking. Inspire fear of terrible enemies. Well, let's fast forward. Yeah, well, and also the war mentality, that's another thing mentioned, but the war of drugs, I call it, because that was proven to be bogus. The global war on terror, which I call the global war of terror, that was also shown to be bogus. The pandemic, that was, well, I mean, it was real. People have gotten ill and many sadly died, but the whole procedure and the authoritarianism with which the media state complex presented the information about that has now proven many falsities. So these are all techniques to inspire fear of terrible enemies about to overwhelm us, and awe for leaders. So whether it's a leader or in the recent thing, it's trust the science, but the science didn't allow for various proponents of herbal medicines or natural remedies. It was enforcement and, you know, fixation on the vaccines. So these are all tactics that, as Chomsky wrote, to rescue us from disaster in the nick of time. some of this started, some of this, so you know, it has me thinking about what's next, what's the next one going to be? Because history proves that over and over there's some kind of crazy something that happens. So, you know, I keep that in the back of my mind. I'm prepared for, well, as prepared as I can be. You know, people worry about nuclear incidents nowadays, and I even read that somewhere a while ago that if there was some news report about a nuclear incident, that would cause immediate panic, but it might be a false flag. So I remain skeptical of any news until I learn more. And one of the tactics, too, that was used a while ago was after Vietnam. There was a photo of Vietnam, as a famous photo of, I think, a woman or a child running naked, and it was, you know, the napalm, whatever it was horrid. And that people seeing that photo helped to stop the Vietnam War. So after that, the powers that do too much, they decided to sanitize the news. So that is one of the reasons now for years and years and years that you don't see much nasty stuff in the news, because they know that affects people. So they decided to sanitize the news. So out of sight, out of mind. And the other thing I find that with the distractions is now that they've sanitized the news, the new distraction has become the gadgets and the technology. So, you know, instead of having, and it, you know, and it's all, I mean, I use it too, but it's all, it's very nicey nice with emojis and smiley faces and cat pictures and, you know, sunsets and beautiful stuff. But that becomes a distraction if we're not talking about the horrors and the nastinesses that are going on under the radar or in plain sight, if we will only look. And like, here are some of the positives that the system of domination is afraid of: independent thought, popular organizing, and pressures for much needed institutional change. And then the other tactic is providing a mass base of, you know, people either were organized and do those things, or they will become a mass base of frightened people for new authoritarian leaders. So one of the things is that the systems of domination tend to make people submissive, and they have to follow along. It's because, you know, if they start to organize, that can be trouble. So, okay, we'll just follow along. That's better. So those are kind of two choices that people make. You can look at your own choices. And another little bit I wanted to mention, which is a good little checkpoint learning technique. Chomsky mentions the terms of political discourse typically have two meanings. One is the dictionary meaning, and the other is a meaning that is useful for serving power, the doctrinal meaning. The doctrinal meaning. So that's why I'm into looking up what words mean and the etymology, because it gives meanings to it. So when, you know, people say democracy and then you see the actions, that's not democracy. It's not of the people. And then I also look to the native brothers and sisters perspective, because I've heard the phrase earth democracy. When we hear democracy, we think of, you know, humans, but that's not true democracy. From the native indigenous people's perspective, democracy is fair treatment for the trees and the waters and the air and the birds. It's not just from the human perspective. So that's why the words are powerful, and the language that gets used in the media and stuff is very powerful in the history books, and it, you know, it literally creates a brainwashing and such like. That's, I want to segue too, at the end of the book, while it does give, you know, some positive suggestions, I would beg to differ, but with the approach, which again, this is something that that Native friends have widened my perspective. So Chomsky ends up with, and that's part of the task that lies before us. There's a growing third world at home. There are systems of illegitimate authority in every corner of the social, political, economic, and cultural worlds. For the first time in human history, we have to face the problem of protecting an environment that can sustain a decent human existence. So while it's well-intentioned, and that was, you know, at the time when environmental issues were coming to the fore, but from the native people's perspective, you know, the environment started going downhill in 1492. And then, again, he's not going to mention the mother, you know, the perspective from Mother Earth. So that tends to be a Western, more intellectual way of thinking is to break things down into categories, social, political, economic, and cultural, and to see the world and to put the environment as something outside of us or over there. Yet from a holistic perspective, it's all connected, and it's not just an environment. It is, East Indians call it Indra's net. It's all connected. What natives refer to as Mother Earth and all the relations, it is all interconnected. So that kind of thinking presents a different approach to how to deal with these situations. If we just go at each individual thing, I mean, maybe you have a specialty. Your specialty is economics, or your specialty is, the quote environment. So those things can work, but I think we get caught into thinking in narrow, compartmentalized thinking if we just go at it from these from that approach and a wider from the intellectual or rational approach, and we need a wider perspective, which I've mentioned before. Some nights I go out at night and I see the little insects and stuff crawling around on the patio, and it's just like, it amazes me how much life and energy there is going on that's, you know, beyond my comprehension to know what those insects are doing and what part they play in the big picture. But at least I know to do what I can to respect them and to, care about them. So, that'll wrap it up for this episode of Nothing is Forgotten, Only Left Behind, a indirect tribute to the wonderful music and songs and spirit and energy messages of Robbie Robertson. He'll be missed. And thank you for listening. Be well.